very much, Daryl. Your words are very, very kind. And of course, this is a very multidisciplinary research program that I'm telling you about, and that certainly is one of the strengths of the work we do here at the Institute. So I'm here to share the findings of the evaluation of the 2012 Family Violence Amendments. They were amendments to the Family Law Act that were intended to support the family law system and professionals working in the system to place greater emphasis on protecting children from harm in making post-separation parenting arrangements. The research that I'm sharing today is the product of the work of a very big team here at the Institute, and I'm really just here to share the findings of the work of that team. Just to let you know that, you know, these views are our views as researchers. They're not the views of the Institute as an official body or the Australian government. So today I'm going to just very briefly recap the main aspects of the reforms that we evaluated. I'll briefly tell you about the methodology. I could go on about that for hours, but I won't. I want to kind of frame up the discussion of the findings by sharing with you our insights into the characteristics of the people who use the family law system. We have now a very significant evidence base based on three separate quantitative data sets that give us very clear insights into who the families are that actually engage with services and courts and lawyers in the post-separation context. I'll then share our research findings, and basically the message is that the reforms have been a step in the right direction, but there continues to be some way to go to realising their aims and objectives. Okay, so the changes were primarily made to Part 7 of the Family Law Act. That's the part that governs the resolution of children's matters. But there were some aspects of the reforms that were wider than Part 7. Those aspects included new definitions of family violence and child abuse, which have widened the range of behaviours that are considered to be family violence, arguably. There's some legal debate about that, but I'm not going to get into that today in very much detail at all. One of the significant aspects of the changes, the new definition of family violence when it's paired with the new definition of child abuse, is that children witnessing family violence is now recognised as a form of child abuse where it results in serious psychological harm. So that's some of the significant definitional aspects. The changes in Part 7 also included provisions that place obligations on parties to disclose and courts to ask about family violence and child abuse, including things like engagement with child protection systems. One of the key aspects of the reforms, and it's a theme throughout this presentation, relates to what have been called the twin pillars of Part 7. So there's a couple of provisions that support these twin pillars, and basically what we mean by twin pillars is that on the one hand there are two considerations that are the primary considerations in making parenting arrangements. One of them is the child's right to a meaningful relationship with each parent after separation. The other is the child's right to be protected from harm, from exposure to family violence, child abuse, and exposure to those things. Now, in the framework prior to the 2012 amendments, those provisions were they were equal, although in chronologically meaningful relationship came first. And one of the concerns that arose after the 2006 family law amendments, so the amendments to the system and the shared parenting provisions, one of the concerns that arose after those amendments was that meaningful relationship was getting more attention than protection from harm. So one of the aspects of the reforms in 2012 was the inclusion of Section 60 CC2A which specifies that where it conflicts with meaningful relationships, protection from harm is to be given greater weight. Now, that provision affects court-based decision-making through the way it is placed in the Act, but it's also specified to be an obligation that advisers need to observe. And advisers are people like family consultants, family lawyers, family dispute resolution practitioners, and so forth. The other aspect of advisers' obligations that changed that I'll be referring to again in the discussion of findings is that advisers after 2012 had an explicit obligation included in the Act that they needed to tell parents that parenting arrangements must be in children's best interests. So there's some of the key aspects of the reform. There was also the repeal of provisions that are considered to inhibit disclosure of concerns. So the so-called friendly parent provision was repealed, and there was also the repeal of a provision in relation to costs orders. There were some practice measures rolled out at the same time as the reforms, and they included that family violence training, a package that was used across the family law system, and the DAWS screening tool, that's the detection of overall risk screening tool. Just briefly to tell you about the methodology, we were very fortunate in that the Attorney General's Department were prepared to support a very extensive and rigorous research program that was able to look at these reforms from a number of different perspectives. So chronologically, the first study in the series was an online survey with family law system professionals. And we surveyed 653 professionals working across the family law system, including judicial officers and registrars, lawyers and non-legal family law system professionals, so family dispute resolution practitioners and so forth. I'd say that the absolute core of this research program, as it has been in our previous research program evaluating the 2006 family law amendments, was the two studies that examined parents' views and experiences. So these were studies, each study was of 6,000 parents who had separated. One study examined pre-reform experiences, one study examined post-reform experiences. And these data from these studies are critical for understanding the impact of the evaluation and a range of other issues on an ongoing basis, things like child support. We also had the Court Outcomes Project, and so this again was an important part of the evaluation research program. We looked at court administrative data around filings and so forth. We had the support of the three courts, the Family Court of Australia, the Federal Circuit Court of Australia and the Family Court of Western Australia, to go into the court registries and collect quantitative data from court files. We've been very fortunate over many years to have very good relationships with the courts, and they continually support our research in this way. So over summer, last summer, we had 12 law students. Some of the people in this room helped us find those students, so thank you. We had 12 law students collecting data in Perth, in Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne from family court files. We also supplemented these quantitative insights on court orders with an analysis of published judgments. So the research questions, quite briefly, have parenting arrangements changed since the reforms? Are more parents disclosing concerns about family violence and child safety to family law system professionals? Are there changes in the patterns of service use following the family violence amendments? We have a system where parents are encouraged to use family dispute resolution unless there are concerns about family violence or child abuse, in which case they are eligible to have an exemption to proceed to court. The reality that our research has shown over many years now is that parents with family violence and child abuse, in some circumstances where professionals consider it's appropriate to proceed, still do prefer to use family dispute resolution. in those situations. So that the service use question was aimed at working out whether or not increased identification of family violence and child abuse would in turn lead to different patterns in service use. We wanted to know how the practices of family law system professionals had changed, how court-endorsed outcomes had changed, and whether there was a change in court practice. We also wanted to look at unintended consequences, positive or negative. So I'm now just going to make a couple of observations on the findings that I'm going to share to assist your, I guess, understanding of the information that follows. One of the interesting insights that we have from this research program is that the impact of the reforms has been different in different parts of the system. Okay, different aspects of the reforms have had different levels of influence in legal and non-legal parts of the system. So court and lawyer practice on the one hand, family dispute resolution practice on the other. One of the observations that emerged from our 2006 evaluation was that there was an uneven set of behaviours and practices across the family law system in relation to family violence and child abuse practice. And basically, you know, what we have consistently found in a range of studies that we've done is that there are professionals for whom practice prior to the reforms was consistent with the aims and objectives of the reforms. And there are other groups of practitioners for whom that's not the case. So the extent to which practice changed depended on the nature of that practice prior to the reforms. The other important issue that we need to bear in mind in looking at these findings is that these were legislative changes, okay? They weren't. It wasn't like 2006 when we had a whole range of new services. These were changes in the legislation. They were intended to change the practice of professionals and through that change the practice of parents, change the experiences of parents. Early into the reforms and at this point in time still, there's very limited appellate jurisprudence interpreting the key aspects of the legislation. And one of the areas where I think this is especially significant is in the interpretation of Section 60CC2A. So this is this so-called tiebreaker provision that says that protection from harm is more important. Okay, so just to kind of illustrate the points that I've just made to set up that understanding, I think, in this audience. One of the questions that we asked in our online survey of professionals to gauge attitudes, professional attitudes to the reforms, was did the family law system need the 2012 family violence reforms? And it was interesting in that majorities of professionals, so on an aggregate basis, there's no question a majority of professionals thought, yes, the family law system needed the family violence reforms. But what's interesting is that the patterns are different among different professional groups. So 60% for judicial officers, 70% for lawyers, nearly 90% for non-legal professionals. So that group is very much, you know, behind the reforms. All the groups are, but it's quite clear that, you know, this is consistent with non-legal professionals' understandings of what child development is all about. These reforms and the way the system works. Similarly, in terms of this notion, the repeal of this friendly parent provision, this is quite a complicated issue. I'm not going to get into it in any great depth. But what's very interesting is the different perceptions about the impact of the repeal of that provision and the way it operated before the reform. So we find that judicial officers are most likely to suggest that the friendly parent provision did not have an inhibiting effect on disclosure. That's different for non-legal professionals. So we have this pattern of results where judicial officers are not seeing, they're not indicating that they see much change in the level of disclosure as a result of this provision. Lawyers are a little bit more strong in seeing a change. And non-legal professionals are stronger still in seeing a change. So non-legal professionals will draw more of a relationship between the repeal of the friendly parent provision and the extent to which parents are willing to disclose concerns about family violence and child abuse. So I'm getting on now to this point about who is it that uses the services and courts. And this slide tells us about the characteristics of the clients who use FDR lawyers and courts. So this is based on a question, what was the main pathway through which you used to resolve your parenting arrangements? Basically, our three studies show very similar patterns in service use in broad terms. We find that FDR is used by about 10% of separated parents. The main pathway of lawyers is nominated by about 6% of separated parents. The main pathway of courts is nominated by about 3% of separated parents. So if you look at those figures in aggregate, it's really only a minority, quite a small minority really, of separated parents that rely on the family law system to any great extent. And so who are these parents? Well, the finding I'm going to focus on here is the parents who have ongoing safety concerns. And so this is a question that we asked our parents when we surveyed them. Do you have ongoing concerns for the safety of yourself or your child as a result of ongoing contact with the other parent? So this is this group with current concerns at the time of the survey. And it's interesting to find that a quarter nominated FDR as their main pathway, a third nominated lawyers, and nearly half nominated courts. So this is the client base of the family law system. Just to explain a little bit more about this construct of safety concerns, we asked our parents what their safety concerns arose from. And, you know, basically each of our studies shows that just under one-fifth of parents in each annual cohort of separated parents has safety concerns. So what are these safety concerns, what are they about? The most common reason parents nominated was emotional abuse or anger issues. Mental health issues were also nominated, and to a greater extent in 2014 compared to 2012. Violent or dangerous behaviour for half, and then alcohol and gambling problems. So these aren't benign sorts of concerns. I don't think for most parents they're not concerns that arise because somebody might be a little bit careless about a child wearing a seatbelt or something like that. So just now to the substantive findings of the evaluation and research program, just telling you about the extent to which identification of family violence, child abuse and safety concerns has changed since the reforms. These are our parents who said, yes, I used one of these three formal pathways to make my parenting arrangements. And we asked them, were you asked about family violence? Were you asked about safety concerns? And this shows the extent to which they were asked about one or the other or both of those concerns. And this is an encouraging finding in that it shows us that there has been an increased emphasis on identifying these issues since the 2012 reforms. So we see that in 2014, nearly 60% of parents said, yes, I was asked, compared with half in 2012. And that's significant when you consider the characteristics of the families who use the system that I've just referred to. But interestingly, again, one of the concerning findings that underpins our observation that there remains some way to go is that a third of parents reported not being asked. And so in a system where the legislation is predicated on different arrangements for children where there are concerns around family violence and or child abuse, and service use is meant to be different, people not being asked when they have the characteristics that I've highlighted at the outset is concerning. So this now turns, this is a more detailed analysis of the data I've just presented, and it presents the findings by pathway. So this tells us about where practice has changed most. And what's really quite interesting is that this tells us that the area where practice changed most was for lawyers, okay? So parents using lawyers reported less often that they were never asked about either of these issues in 2014 compared to 2012. So 41% being never asked shifted to 30% being never asked. And in the courts, there's a change as well, and what we see in the courts is an increased emphasis on asking about safety concerns. But again, in each of the three pathways, nearly 3 in 10 report never being asked. So the DOORS screening tool. Okay, are you using the DOORS screening tool? We asked our professional respondents in our survey. Interestingly, half of lawyers said rarely or never. Nearly 70% of non-legal professionals said rarely or never. So our conclusion on DOORS, there's limited uptake, and there are positive and negative views about DOORS. There's quite an extensive analysis in the report if you're interested to go into that topic in more detail. I should say that our 4 reports, totaling 700 pages, are available on our website, and there is an easily digestible 100-page synthesis report included in the suite. So if you're looking to get to sleep one night, there you are. So looking at the impact of the reforms on dispute resolution dynamics, this again is a very interesting set of findings. And what we found is that the 2012 Family Violence Amendments have supported dispute resolution in agreement-based pathways. So actually not just family dispute resolution, but also discussions. I haven't highlighted that here, but discussions has also become an avenue that people are happier with. So we see that more people are coming out of FDR with agreements. So who are the people that are coming out of FDR with agreements? And are they just the ones affected by family violence? Well, this again is a really interesting finding because no, it's not just the parents affected by family violence. We see an increase in agreements among the physical violence group, fairly stable in the emotional abuse alone group, and then there's an increase in agreements in the no family violence group. And one of the aspects of the reforms that we consider might be significant in producing these findings is the change to advisors' obligations in relation to section 60D1 for the lawyers in the room, which tells advisors that they need to inform parents that parenting arrangements must be in children's best interests. Okay, so some other aspects of the findings that tell us about dynamics. Interestingly, what we found was that fathers with safety concerns were more likely to report that they had attempted to stop or limit contact with the other parent after the reform. The findings for mothers were stable, and it remained a majority of mothers that had said that. Interesting dynamics probably related to the preceding finding. Our court outcomes study shows that fathers as applicants for parenting orders has increased after the reform, so they're more likely to instigate an application for parenting orders. Mothers as respondents has increased. So turning now to the impact of the reforms on family violence and child abuse concerns being raised in court matters. This slide shows us the proportion of matters in which concerns around family violence and child abuse were raised across the whole sample. So what I need to tell you about this sample of court orders is that it included 3 sub-samples. Part of the sample was judicial determination, so they were orders made by a judge after a contested trial. The second sub-sample was orders that were made by a judge after the parties agreed having instigated court action but agreeing to settle prior to or during trial. The third part of the third subsample was the so-called consent orders, pure consent orders where parents reach an agreement, take it to court, and the court makes orders in those terms where it's satisfied that it should do that. So looking at that whole sample, we do find that allegations concerning family violence and child abuse have increased across the whole sample from under 10% to 17%. Looking in more depth at the allegations of child abuse and the type of child abuse that's alleged, and thinking about the change in definition in relation to children witnessing violence, it's interesting that the proportion of cases raising psychological abuse has increased from 6 to 13%. Physical abuse increased from 6% to 12%, and neglect has also increased. So, well, I'd suggest that there's a range of aspects of the reforms that feed into those findings, including the definition and including the obligations around asking and the disincentives to telling. I know I'm quite aware that I'm a bit short on time, so I'm going to tell you what changes have occurred in parenting arrangements. Now, this slide depicts the range of parenting arrangements among our samples of separated parents. So these are the samples of 6,000 separated parents. And we have seen a subtle shift, and that shift, although the broad patterns are the same, the subtle shift is from fewer arrangements where the children live with their mother for the majority of time. There are less arrangements in that category, and it's a very subtle shift. And the area where the number of arrangements has increased to make up for that shift is arrangements where the father sees the child during the daytime only. Okay, so it's quite a subtle shift. We've gone from an arrangement where the father might have the child overnight to an arrangement where the father has the child during the daytime only. So that's the whole 6,000 sample, and we need to bear in mind that, you know, it is a minority of parents in that sample who have engaged with the system to reach their parenting arrangements. This just tells us about the arrangements that have made where there are safety concerns among these parents. Okay, and again, this reflects this same subtle shift. Where there are safety concerns, we find that parents, after the reforms, by a couple of percentage points, are more likely to report arrangements involving daytime contact only. And I'll just highlight a consistent finding across our three studies is that safety concerns in the general population of parents are associated with arrangements where usually the mother has the child for most of the time or all of the time, and the child never sees or rarely sees the father. So they're just the population changes. Turning now more specifically to court orders, again, these data show the situation among the whole range of court files. If you look at the entire sample of court files, we don't see a great deal of change. Shared parental responsibility is at 85% roughly in each time period, and, you know, sole responsibility to mother 10% in each time period. So if you look at the sample as a whole, there's not a lot of change. Thinking about shared parental responsibility arrangements, it's interesting, shared care time arrangements in particular, the lower part of that slide. We have seen a shift away from shared care orders in the whole sample where there are allegations of both family violence and child abuse. So they went from nearly 19% pre-reform to 11% post-reform. I'm just going to highlight in those different sub-samples, and I'm aware I'm not probably talking to a lawyer-heavy audience, so I won't spend too much time on this, and, you know, it's all detailed in the court or outcomes report for the lawyers who are interested. We found some different patterns according to the different sub-samples. So it's interesting that in the judicial determination sub-sample, shared parental responsibility went down. Shared time stayed the same. In the consent after proceedings were initiated sample, the pattern was different. Okay, we had a stable level of shared parental responsibility, but shared time went down. In the where there's no allegations of family violence or child abuse, the pattern basically stayed the same. So there are no change in terms of the orders where people are saying, okay, well, there's no face-to-face time with one parent, or there's supervised time. That hasn't changed in the pre- and post-reform period. I'm just going to kind of summarise some of the material that we've seen by referring to professionals' views, returning to professionals' views. And what do professionals think about whether or not the legal system has had the capacity to screen adequately for family violence and child abuse since the reforms? It's interesting to see that a majority of judicial officers say yes. Just under half of lawyers say yes. And even fewer non-legal professionals say yes. So again, we see these disciplinary differences. Returning to this theme of the twin killers, we asked our professional respondents whether or not they thought that adequate priority was placed on the child's right to meaningful relationship on the one hand and protection from harm on the other hand in the family law system after the reforms. And what we have is we have the continuation of a significant discrepancy between the views, the relative importance placed on each of these issues. So adequate priority, nearly 100% for meaningful relationship. Protection from harm, 68%. So clearly the aim is bringing protection from harm in line with meaningful relationship, or even bringing it above meaningful relationship, remains a work in progress. And again, this just highlights the disciplinary differences. Judicial officers are, you know, nearly 100% saying adequate priority were placed on both of those issues. Much bigger discrepancies for lawyers, so lawyers 20 percentage points difference between whether the proportion that agreed that meaningful involvement with both parents was given adequate priority compared to protection from harm. And a similar discrepancy among non-legal professionals. So that's very interesting. I'm just turning now to parents' views. So what do parents think about the family law system and outcomes for children? We asked our parents a whole range of questions, and I'm focusing on the child-focused one. Did our parents think that the family law system helped to find the best outcomes for children? Again, when we look at these data, we need to remember that a minority of parents engaged with the system to any great extent. Among parents, there was quite a significant prevalence of don't know responses because, you know, they didn't use the system, so they don't know. But the ones who offered an opinion, this is what they said, helps to find the best outcome for children. Agree, 41% pre-reform, and it's increased after the reforms to 45%. When we looked at these data by different experiences of family violence, so the physical violence group agreement increased, the emotional abuse group agreement increased, no violence, it was more or less stable. And if we analysed this by the groups of parents who had safety concerns, there was no real change in their experience. Looking now at parents' views on whether the family law system protects children's safety. Okay, so we had this statement, the family law system protects the safety of children. It was fairly stable and half of all parents agreed. But if you looked at the levels of agreement among parents with safety concerns, and there were different groups according to whether they had safety concerns for themselves and their child, for the child only, for themselves only, or they were in this group where they said, well, we don't have any concerns because our child is not seeing the other parent. It was that latter group where there was an increase in agreement. The other groups were stable. So unintended consequences, parenting arrangements were taking longer to resolve for all parents actually. Even the court users and the non-court users, we have that finding. And basically the conclusion, I'm going to wrap up now, the conclusion that emerges from this research program is that the reforms are a step in the right direction, as I indicated at the outset. There is a greater emphasis on screening and identification of concerns about family violence and child abuse. We have seen subtle shifts in parenting arrangements. The reforms have supported agreement-based pathways. So there are more agreements in FDR. People are happier with some aspects of FDR. People are much happier when they've said that they've used discussions. So that's very interesting. Some way to go. It's quite clear that this issue around screening and assessment remains a challenge. And there are issues around the tools. There are issues around practice models. There are issues around the way the notion of screening and assessment fits in with some aspects of the culture of the family law system in some places, in some parts of the system. And I think there's some particular complexities around screening and assessment in legal practice. There are concerns around parents' trajectories and implications of delays, particularly for parents where there are issues around family violence and safety concerns. And at this point in time, I think we have to conclude that Section 60 CC2A has had a limited impact, and we can see that in a number of areas where we don't have parity between meaningful involvement and protection from harm. Protection from harm is still down here. So just kind of to give you an indication of where things are going from here, some of you will be aware that the Family Law Council has a reference from the Attorney General who has asked for advice on how the family law system can better meet the needs of families with complex issues. And there was an interim report dealing with mainly the intersection of the family law system and the child protection system that's been given to the government, and there is a range of, there's further work going on now, okay, and a lot of that work focuses on collaboration and information sharing across agencies, and it's due to report to the Attorney General next year in the middle of the year. So I just want to conclude, this research, a lot of effort and a lot of different people, a lot of different organisations supported this research, so the Federal Attorney General's Department funded it. We're always very grateful for the people who participate in our research, parents and professionals. Always grateful for the support of the courts and the support of a range of different bodies across the family law system that always help us recruit our participants. So, you know, the family law section, FRSA. And then we draw our samples from the DHS database, and we're always grateful for access to that database because it enables us to draw consistent samples for these studies. And so these are the evaluation reports, and the names of the team members are there. So, you know, it is very much a team effort, this work, and you can read the reports and download them and have a lot of fun.